Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If Congress leaves by Friday of this week, in other words, leaves Washington, it could be the earliest election year departure for lawmakers since 1960, when the 80th Congress beat it out of town on September 1, more than 2 months before Election Day. That is, according to Washington insider blogger Jamie Dupre. He says that the difference is that the 80th Congress, back in 1960, had finished its work and adjourned. Mission accomplished. While the 112th Congress has, as Jamie Dupre put it, hardly broken a sweat on the budget and much more. Joining us now to review some of the unfinished business is Stephen Koff, the Plain Dealers Washington Bureau Chief since 1998, covering and supervising coverage of national policy and politics with an eye toward Ohio. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also, Jessica Wehrman, she's a Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch. Her stories also appear in the Dayton Daily News. Welcome back to the show, Jessica.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So for our listeners, is there anything out there on the menu of unfinished business that particularly irks you or that, on the other hand, maybe you're happy they didn't get to it? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So there is a big, long list of unfinished business. But first, Stephen, why don't we get started with what they did do? That should take at least a few minutes.
Well, you know, they did. They passed the Belarus Democracy and Human Rights Act, reaffirming the United States' support for democracy and human rights in Belarus. They redesignated the Noxubee National Wildlife Refuge as the Sam D. Hamilton Noxubee National Wildlife Refuge. That's in Mississippi, in case you're going down there. They renamed a lot of buildings. In fact, in mid-August, the Fiscal Times took a look at what they did and said that of 65 bills passed this year that cleared both chambers, at least 19 of those actually had something to do with naming government buildings. Now, they actually did accomplish one or two things, including a short-term extension of the 3.4% student loan. A subsidized student loan interest rate. So, you know, they got that done. That was through actually a different bill, though. That was through a highway bill, oddly enough. And that bill just sort of continues funding for the highway system so that road construction doesn't shut down. There were attempts at doing a lot of things, but since the two chambers can't agree on much at all, none of those things happened either.
Jessica, is it fair to compare the two Congresses, the 80th and the 112th?
Yeah, why not? I mean, basically, Congress is supposed to have, just like anyone has a job description of being being tasked with certain responsibilities, Congress has certain responsibilities, and they have not done them. For example, they didn't pass a budget bill. The House passed a budget bill, but the Senate did not. President Obama has not signed one single appropriations bill, but that's not his fault because the Senate hasn't voted on one, and the House has voted on 6 of the 12 that they pass. So, you know, when you invited me to appear on this, I talked to a colleague and I said, well, we're going to talk about what Congress did this year. And my colleague said, well, that's going to be a very short conversation. They've achieved very little. And, you know, he's right. But I actually think there's a reason why listeners should probably be troubled by this. You know, not only has Congress failed to agree on much of anything, but in doing so, you could argue that they've abrogated their basic responsibilities. And in fact, there's a looming fiscal crisis that could actually send us into a recession again if they don't act, at least, you know, if they don't act during a lame duck session after the elections.
My guests are Jessica Wehrman, reporter for the Columbus Dispatch Washington Bureau, and also Stephen Koff, Washington Bureau Chief for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. What do you think should or should not have gotten done this year in this session of Congress? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to our Facebook page and post it there. You know, couldn't it be that, like I used to do in college, sometimes I kind of walked around with the books and took my time before I wrote the term paper? Maybe they're thinking about things. These are weighty subjects, or do you really need to be in session and be talking about them in committee meetings and you know, doing that sort of a thing?
Well, Congress has kind of slipped into this interesting habit of waiting till the very, very last minute. The debt deal was a prime example of this, and waiting till, you know, the last hour of the last day before passing something, even if it's a temporary something. A lot of these authorization bills, Steve just talked about the student loan bill, which was a highway bill, was actually a last minute because they were approaching a deadline. And that was actually, it was supposed to be, the highway bill is traditionally a five-year bill that allows states and localities to plan. But instead, they have a three-year bill. I believe it's a three-year. It could be a two-year bill as well, but it's a temporary reauthorization as opposed to, you know, what's supposed to be done.
And likewise, with the extension of the 3.4% student loan interest rate, that's just for a year, right?
Yeah, that's short-term, and it's not long-term, so students shouldn't get their hopes up. And they also, by the way, closed some favorable provisions for students while doing that. For instance, government used to subsidize your interest for a series of months, 6 or 9 months after graduation, so you didn't have to start paying back right away. I think it was 6 months. So, you know, you can actually maybe have hopes of getting a job first. There was a grace period, and they've ended that. Likewise, subsidized loans for graduate students are no longer available. So, you know, it's not like what they did was necessarily good for everybody. Coming back to the question that you had in terms of, well, it's just like, you know, putting off your term papers or your homework, which we've all done, and cramming all night. But in this case, it seems as if what they're putting off is making any hard decisions until they see which way the wind is going to blow on November 6th.
Yeah, you know what? I talked to a congressman who actually has said he basically doesn't believe it's a big deal that Congress isn't getting anything done. He said he had no expectation that Congress would get anything done because he said, you know what? Let's let the American people decide who they want in charge before we make a lot.
Isn't that what they did 4 years ago, though?
Yep. And, I mean, they were elected 2 years ago, so, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Anthony and Pataskala, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Hey. Listen, I was just going to say Obama has a very, very good case of running against a do-nothing Congress. Everyone knows that one man is not responsible. In other words, he can't make them do the work or pass these bills, and he can't do anything by himself. Traditionally, Republicans and Democrats work together. But right now, basically what the Republicans have said, their number one job was to make sure this guy did not get a second election. And they're holding it. I mean, they're actually doing what they said they were going to do by doing nothing.
But are they? But thank you, Anthony, for that call. But do you think they're necessarily achieving that goal, if indeed that? Well, I mean, it was a stated goal by one congressional leader. But by doing very little or nothing, in some people's estimation, do they achieve the goal of doing harm necessarily to Barack Obama? Stephen Koff?
In a way, because they can say he hasn't done anything, he hasn't passed a budget, or he hasn't at least goaded the Senate to pass a budget. That's sort of the way they put it more recently is, you know, he's not using the bully pulpit, or he's not using his authority to get Congress to do things. It could. The problem with that, though, is the Republicans in Congress aren't achieving what they want to achieve either. They've been unable to repeal Obamacare despite their repeated attempts to do so. They haven't passed bills that they would like to be able to pass either. So you sort of have this standoff, and nobody necessarily looks good. I mean, I haven't seen polls that compare necessarily the favorability of, let's say John Boehner, Harry Reid, and Barack Obama. But I think that most Americans sort of see each of them as an independent person, and therefore, as the caller, I suppose, suggested, Obama isn't necessarily going to get the blame.
Thank you, Anthony, for that call. David and Bexley are on the air. Welcome to the show, David.
Hi.
Hi.
I was interested in a couple of bills, farm bill and subsidies for wind energy, but I'd like to find out what the progress on those are.
You know what? I just did a story last week on the farm bill. So the farm bill, which also includes food assistance for, I think, like 44 million Americans, that is supposed to expire on September 30th. The Senate had passed a bill earlier, and the House has not been able, they passed it out of committee, but it hasn't gone to the full floor yet. And so it's supposed to expire, and it's supposed to expire at the end of this month. Now, last month, the House did pass a disaster assistance bill that's supposed to cover, you know, you'll remember we had a huge drought this year. But there's been a standoff, and, you know, Friday is fast approaching, and Friday would be the day when they go out of session. So it doesn't really look good at this point, which has been incredibly frustrating for farmers. You know, farmers by nature are involved in an incredibly uncertain career. And, you know, during tough years, such as this year, they rely on federal assistance to support them. So this contributes to a really high level of uncertainty among, you know, those who would benefit when the federal government has a plan like, you know, the farmers.
When you say it expires, and did you say September?
September 30th.
30th.
And, you know, they've got till the end of the week. So I'm not really sure if they pass something or if they shove something in the CR that would keep it running. It's really uncertain at this point what's going to happen.
Any thoughts on that, Stephen Koff?
No, I have to say that because I really focus on the Cleveland area, not mm-hmm. a big farming area.
Right.
I defer to my colleagues like Jessica to cover the farm bill.
I'm a farmer's granddaughter. I keep
okay.
track of this.
All right. David, thanks for your call.
Okay.
Take care. Frank in Canal Winchester, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Frank.
Good morning. I'd like to attack the media in this case.
Okay.
In all 50 states, I believe there's only 3 states that have an independent board that's attacking redistricting. It all comes back to us. Why do we want to blame X, Y, and Z if we can't get rid of gerrymandering so that the two extremes don't go, at least to the House? This is a root thing in the United States, and the media isn't focusing on a daily basis if they're serious about doing something in Congress. We got to get rid of gerrymandering so the two extremes don't go up there. And what happened in the state of Ohio years ago when there was a redistricting on the ballot and it didn't pass?
Right.
Is the same thing going on this year? Thank you.
All right, Frank. Point well taken. I mean, a lot of the polarization in Congress is a function of how we elect our lawmakers at the primary level.
What's fascinating about that is as he said, you know, there are a few states who are addressing it, but they're not addressing it nationally. And so Ohio is one of the states that is going to try to attempt to do something about that. But what's going to happen is, first of all, go back to the last congressional elections. As a result of gerrymandering, as a result of just the way the districts were already somewhat stacked, Ohio lost a number of Democrats, gained a number of Republicans. Then in the new redistricting, it kind of balanced out a little bit. You know, the new largely Democratic district in Columbus, for instance, there's probably one competitive district in the entire state.
And that's the rub. There's no competition at the primary level.
There's no competition at the primaries. But what's going to happen if this bill passes in Ohio, then suddenly, you've got people in Ohio who are running for Congress, and the people in their districts have no idea who they are. We hear from people in Northeast Ohio regularly who say to me, okay, is Kucinich going to be my congressman again? Whose district am I in? You know, they don't know these folks. They don't know Jim Renacci. They may not know Betty Sutton. They may not know that these guys are going to be, in fact, on their ballots when they show up at the polls. But if this bill passes in Ohio with the voters this time, then we'll do this all over again, and we'll start once again with fresh districts in 2 years, which is just kind of bizarre for the citizens to become familiar with the lawmakers or with the candidates. It's a challenge.
You know, it's interesting in this void of actual competitive general elections, you've seen some groups pop up like the Campaign for Primary Accountability that is trying to unseat incumbents during the primary. So it'll be interesting to see how Citizens United impacts that and if we see more groups targeting people in the primary in the future.
My guests are Jessica Wehrman. She's a reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Washington Bureau, and also Stephen Koff, a bureau chief in Washington for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In California, anyone arrested on a felony charge can be swabbed with a Q-tip and see their DNA added to a growing genetic database. No warrant needed. The FBI is reportedly working on a facial recognition system to help police ID suspects. I'm Neil Conan, Technology, Law Enforcement, and Civil Liberties, Tracking Criminals. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4, right here on 89.7 NPR News. 65 degrees with some light rain. Expect showers and thunderstorms off and on throughout the day. A high of 67. Partly cloudy tonight and chilly. A low of 41. Support for 89.7 comes from the Jazz Arts Group, America's oldest not-for-profit jazz organization, celebrating their 40th anniversary season with a two-night performance with legendary Tonight Show bandleader Doc Severinsen. Doc and the Columbus Jazz Orchestra will play September 28th and 29th at the Southern Theater. Details at jazzartsgroup.org. All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm talking with Jessica Wehrman of the Columbus Dispatch and also Stephen Koff of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. They both cover Washington, Washington politics and public policy and Congress. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about Congress right now. They're getting ready to fly the coop by the end of the week. And we're talking about what they did and didn't do. And it didn't take long to talk about what they did do. But if there's something out there that you wish they would do or hope they don't do, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page. You can tweet us at WOSU All Sides. Bill in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thanks for taking my call.
Welcome.
I've got a question, particularly for the Dispatch reporter. Historically, the Dispatch has always endorsed the Republican candidate for president. They did it this time, even endorsing Sarah Palin and John McCain. So what makes you think they would have done any better? And all this reporting about how it's equal on both sides, it's not equal on both sides. The Republicans are intentionally blocking everything. Their filibuster level is incredibly high. And so it's easy for the Dispatch to say it's equal on both sides because they're going to endorse the Republicans.
Okay. Well, you know, Bill, as a former editorial writer and a member of the editorial board for the Columbus Dispatch, I'll vouch for Jessica. She has nothing to do with their editorial stance. I'm not sure it's fair to ask her that of her, but Jessica, if you want to respond.
No, there's a wall between between newspaper writers, you know, on the news pages and the editorial writers. I'm not aware of what they're writing. I'm sure they keep apprised of my budget, but there's a wall between them, so I don't have any sort of role in endorsements whatsoever.
All right, Bill, thanks for the call. Britta in Columbus. Welcome to the show, Britta.
Thank you. My question is that in this election year, it seems that everybody is talking about the middle class and we have to help the middle class, so on and so forth. And my question goes back to the student loans that you were talking about. As far as getting rid of the grace period and the student loans for graduate students, and like I'm smack dab in the middle of the middle class, and I don't qualify for any kind of assistance, so all I get is student loans. And it just seems that that just seems to be kind of a it just doesn't make sense to me, and I don't really understand why those are the kinds of things that keep getting cut or keep not being addressed when everybody's talking about middle class.
Stephen Koff.
Sure. Yeah. I it's interesting that you bring that up. I had the same situation many years ago when I was in graduate school, and I had a low-paid job. I was leaving my low-paid job to go back to school, get a master's degree. I apparently had made too much money to get a subsidized loan, though, so I ended up with loans at that point at 12% interest. And, you know, I felt the same way. On the other hand, I suppose you could say, well, look, I still had the gumption to go do it regardless, pay off my loans, and so did I really need that subsidy? I don't know. It would have made my life a whole lot easier, though. You know, it becomes difficult when you're dealing with limited resources and Congress and their defense. Where do you draw the line? You know, do you say, well, if you make above $30,000, above $40,000, above $50,000, then we're not going to subsidize your loan? That becomes a little bit tricky.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Britta.
Thank you.
If anybody else has a question or comment for our guests, Jessica Werman and Stephen Koff, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, all right, for the 16th straight year, Congress is not finishing the budget bills on time. I guess it starts to make you wonder, does it really matter? What difference does it make to the rest of us, to us little people?
Tina, it's interesting because that's been the same with appropriations. I mean, you've done all these appropriations bills. Now they're being passed largely through a CR. At the end of this week, Congress is going to pass a continuing resolution that keeps the government operational. So the doors are going to stay open, and that's swell. But I think there's maybe something to be said for, planning and thinking ahead. The five-year transportation bill, not to keep going back to that, is supposed to be giving a sort of a thoughtful look at where we want to go within the next 5 years, and also giving some certainty to state highway departments so they can make a plan and say, this is what we need. We have crumbling infrastructure. Here's how we fill the gap. So, I mean, you could have this philosophical conversation about, what's the point when we can just go ahead and pass this bill and just keep the doors open.
The lack of a budget bill, I think, is emblematic of the larger problem that we're all addressing today, which is you've got to have agreement on where you are going. I mean, it's a blueprint, and it's really important to have a blueprint. But, again, the two parties, the two chambers can't agree on where they want to go. So until you get there, how can you have a blueprint?
You know, what's interesting is that this standoff, or really the series of standoffs, is kind of indicative of what could be a really profound debate. What should the role of the federal government be in average Americans' lives? You hear so much about this. And there's one line of debate says that the role should be nothing, that the federal government should have a minimal, if any, role in people's lives. But then you rarely find someone who's unhappy that their grandma gets Medicare, or that their highways lack potholes, or that the food they eat is safe. So, it's not really as easy a debate as it sounds. In reality, there's a lot of really stupid regulations out there that are onerous and cumbersome and nearly impossible to comply with. But, to say we need to get rid of them kind of minimizes the complicated and, occasionally helpful role the government does have.
Well, you don't have to be pro-regulation to go through those, a lot of them, stupid regulations and find out, well, there was always a reason for it.
I mean, it could be a really – what's frustrating is it could be a potentially very interesting debate, but, nothing is getting done and there's no consensus reached, so.
Taxes. The House and Senate have passed competing bills on what to do about the expiration of the current income tax rates, the Bush tax cuts at the end of this year. I thought they took care of that last year.
They were all short-term.
Okay.
it's always temporary. And that's what's a little bit scary at this point, is putting off major decisions like that until after the election. There's not much time to get it done then. And, the bond rating houses are looking at that and considering whether to cut the United States bond rating just a notch. I don't think anybody thinks the United States is really going to default or have a problem paying its bills. But, again, it's that lack of even short-term planning at this point that's a little bit troublesome, if not worrisome.
Well, and you talk about the things that we haven't done. There's all these tax cuts that are set to expire at the end of the year. You've got the payroll tax cut that's coming up again. You've got doc fix. And then, add to that sort of this mandatory cuts that were passed by Congress last year with the Budget Control Act. I mean, that's that's a lot to do. I mean, for anybody with a term paper that's coming due, that's one heck of a term paper.
My guests, so once again, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guests are Stephen Koff of the Washington Bureau for the Cleveland Plain Dealer and Jessica Werman of the Washington Bureau for the Columbus Dispatch. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about what the Congress, which ends its work, so to speak, at the end of the week, what it has or hasn't done, what it has or has not put off until after the election. We'd like to know whether you're happy about some of the things they've put off or are concerned. 614-292-8513. Well, has either house done a better job of getting to things than the other? Now, granted, the makeup is very different. The Senate is controlled by the Democrats, but it might as well just be even Steven. And the House is more controlled by the Republicans have more leeway over there.
I would say the House, in a way, has done a better job of passing what the Republican leadership wants to pass in the House of Representatives because they've got the numbers. They can pass things with a simple majority. They don't have to worry about the cloture rules or the getting 60 votes. And that means they are able to again, pass bill after bill to in their own House, that is only, to end Obamacare, for instance, and to at least advance the House GOP agenda. I think that they've been fairly effective at doing that. The Senate is a little bit tougher. It's a little more independent-minded. You know, once in a while you have folks coming together. You did have, I think it was actually late last year, but in this Congress, the Senate passing Sherrod Brown's bill to hold China accountable for currency manipulation, and that's a bill that the House just refuses to even take up. But I think that there are more examples of, even if they're lopsided or if they're one-sided measures, more examples of the House succeeding on those.
Jessica?
Yeah, I would agree with Steve. And part of that is the, as he mentioned, the Senate rules cloture. You have to have a pretty large majority to pass anything in the Senate. But the House has done a more effective job of advancing their own. The House Republicans have done a more effective job, I think, of advancing their own agenda than the Senate. And partly is kind of by the nature of the Senate with its rules.
Bill in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Bill. Okay, let's try. Bill in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Okay, Bill is not with us. Too bad. All right, so we've mentioned the sequestration or the sequester, you know, whatever that means. But there's no deal on whether Congress will put off or amend the scheduled $110 billion in automatic budget cuts set to take effect across the board, although the House has made a plan to block the defense portion of those cuts. And that, but again, that's just the House.
Yeah, this is actually, you know, I feel like the reporter's job is just to sort of tell people to what degree they should freak out about stuff. And I, you know what? I think that I'm actually a little bit freaked out about this. So to give background to folks who, you know, need background, last year Congress passed this Budget Control Act. This is part of the deal to raise the debt ceiling. And the bill created a specially appointed congressional committee that was, you know, tasked with paring down $1.2 trillion from the federal deficit over 10 years. And the committee couldn't reach an agreement. So now we've got these sweeping mandatory cuts. Leon Panetta, the defense secretary, called these doomsday cuts, and they are, and not just for defense. There's one analysis that was commissioned by the Aerospace Industries Association that found that this could cost the U.S. economy something like 2.1 million jobs beginning in January, including more than 40,000 in Ohio. The cuts are most sweeping and will have the biggest impact on the Defense Department. That's like they'll have to absorb something like $500 billion in cuts in addition to a 10-year plan, $487 billion budget reduction. So, you know, if you're at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, you're understandably a little bit nervous about these cuts. You know, as well as, you know, Ohio has a pretty expansive swath of defense contractors who could be impacted by this. So it's worth being concerned about.
Once again, it goes to the issue of how can you plan for the future when there's this kind of cut looming, even if it's not going to just you don't know.
You don't know. And, you know, the Defense Department is such a large and cumbersome bureaucracy by nature that, you know, they had to kind of start planning for these cuts immediately after the Budget Control Act was passed. You know, I don't know what the specific details of it, but they've had to already kind of start the ball rolling on this. So they have to stop that ball rolling. And you can sort of go with that metaphor about, you know, the difficulty of stopping such momentum.
Stephen?
Yeah, and there's so little time at this point. I mean, there are some proposals. Rob Portman has talked about the possibility of just a one-year, very limited sequester. But remember, that's how we got here. Everybody's saying, well, we'll negotiate and we'll come up with something, and we'll just sort of set this as the nuclear option. So, you know, this is the trigger. If we can't come up with something else, then we'll have this sequester. But we'll never get there. But guess what? They got there, and here we are. And you know, there's very, very limited time. Meantime, as Jessica suggested, there are decisions that have to be made by people by the beginning of January. Certainly, if you're an employer, you know, we're very likely to see more pink slips or at least more warnings to people who work for defense contractors that, hey, you know, you may not be working as much next year. And, you know, how can that be very good for the economy? You know, we want to sell cars and we want to sell houses. Well, how do you buy a house and how do you buy a car if you work for a defense contractor and you're not sure whether the government money is going to be there or not?
You know, you hear so much during this election about, you know, businesses being concerned about the uncertainty. My God, this is a prime example of uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to stress that it's not just the Defense Department that would be, this is all a discretionary spending. So if you're living in Columbus and you're very interested in the research hospitals and all of the fascinating research organizations, you know, they would absorb some of this impact. So, you know, there's really interesting stuff going on, for example, at Nationwide Children's Hospital, great research projects. And, you know, this is a threat to them. And it's also a threat to those who are entering research careers because
mm-hmm.
that pool of funding by which a researcher could, you know, do his job would, you know, be cut.
Mark, you're not Bill, you're Mark.
That was a little glitch.
Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yep.
I've been following, but then I kind of lost track of it in the past couple of weeks. The audit the Federal Reserve bill, which I think started in the House, and I believe it passed the House. But I was just wondering what the current status was of it, if you knew, and what you think maybe the election results might, how that might affect the future prospects of the audit Federal Reserve bill.
I don't expect it to pass in this Congress. The Democrats are going to be opposed to it. A number of Democrats are going to be opposed to it. A number of others are going to be opposed to it. Next Congress, I also see it as very difficult because, again, you're going to need 60 votes in the Senate. And regardless of which chamber controls the Senate, I just see that as rather difficult. Whether you're for or against it, it does certainly change the nature of the Federal Reserve's independence, and there are plenty of people who believe that the Fed needs to retain its independence.
All right.
All right, Mark. Thanks for calling. Melissa in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Hi, Ann. Thanks. I just have a quick question because I don't really understand, like, why our government is set up the way that it is, because the two-party system just seems so incredibly inefficient. Nothing can ever get done because each group is always warring against the other, and then they just kind of say, like, oh, well, we couldn't reach an agreement, so we just couldn't do our jobs. Like, if anyone in the American general public said that, I mean, I would be fired if I went to my boss and said, like, oh, I couldn't agree with my coworkers, we couldn't figure it out, so we just decided, you know, we're just not going to do it. Then it just seems really inefficient to have a two-party system. Has it always been a two-party system, or is it something where, like, over the years this just happened? Like, why don't we have three parties or four parties so that something could get done?
You know, the way Melissa puts it, Jessica and Stephen, you know, politicians are always talking about making government run like business. And if you didn't get your job done, you'd get fired.
Well, this is intentional. That's the beauty of this. And was it designed to be two parties? No, it was designed, though, to be two chambers. And, you know, once in a while you have a third party showing some influence there. The counterargument to that is, though, it keeps extreme things from happening, or it should keep extreme things from happening. You know, the Senate supposedly is a little more deliberative, a little bit slower in the way it does things. And so it keeps wacky things from happening, perhaps. There are plenty of people who are listening who I'm sure disagree with that because they look at the stimulus or they look at the health care bill or whatever, and they might not like it. But generally, it keeps just really goofy and wacky things from happening, keeps things in the balance. And by design, perhaps things aren't supposed to happen all that quickly. The problem is this year is just so wacky, to use my own word.
You know, I think that there's an interesting point to be made here, which is it's traditionally been, I mean, I was thinking back to times when maybe there was, you know, it's always been basically a two-party system with perhaps a third party, again, showing influence, as Steve said. But one thing that I think has had a particular impact this year is the death of the moderate. You know, because we've become so polarized, there are few in Congress who can effectively bridge the gap and can help find compromise and govern. You know, we lost earlier this year, Steve LaTourette announced his retirement, and this was a rare guy who could vote with the Democrats on occasion, but who is considered extremely credible with his own party.
An Ohioan.
He was an Ohioan from Steve's neck of the woods. You know, I think that, you've seen an increasing number of moderates become frustrated with the polarization and decide to step down. And I think that that has had an impact on this high level of polarization.
Well, and two, you need more than just a few moderates to manage the bridge. It's like a rope bridge now that's coming unraveled, and you need a few more than just a few, right, Steve? I mean, it takes more than that anyway.
Oh, it does take more than that. But, you know, some people have jokingly referred to Steve Lattret as being John Boehner's conscience. But you know, I mean, George Voinovich was another case where mm-hmm. once he announced that he was retiring, now this is not in this Congress, but right. once he announced that he was retiring, he became freed to kind of, voice his opposition to the partisanship. But even now, if you talk to him once in a while, he shares that concern, and he feels that, you know, everybody's just posturing, and, it's not very good for this nation.
Well, back in the olden days when he was governor, he was considered pretty conservative. But by the time he hit Congress, you know, he morphed into something of a moderate in the Senate.
Well,
yeah.
In the party, you could argue the party itself moved rightward. So, I mean,
Right. Yeah. Well, we're going to take another break. Melissa, thanks for your call. And
you're welcome.
It's the question of the century. No question. Take care. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Gaith Abdul-Ahad talks about traveling with Syrian rebel fighters for his new PBS Frontline documentary. He says the rebels don't have enough helmets, flak jackets, or experience.
In Syria, you meet someone in the morning and they die in the end of the day. As one of the officers was saying, the only thing we have plenty of is men.
Join us.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. It's Tech Tuesday with reviews of the new iPhone 5 and talk about political apps that help you navigate the chaos. That's Tech Tuesday from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News. 65 degrees with light rain, showers off and on throughout the day, a high of 67. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 41 degrees. Sunshine and a high of 66 for Wednesday. Support for 89.7 comes from the Midland Theater presenting Capital Steps, who began as a group of Senate staffers who set out to satirize their employers and the government. Capital Steps will perform Saturday evening, October 27th, at the historic Midland Theater in Newark. More details and tickets at MidlandTheater.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about what Congress has achieved, which was in the first few minutes of the show, and what Congress has not achieved in this session, which for all intents and purposes ends at the end of this week. Of course, they could have a lame duck session after the election on November 6th. Joining me today in the discussion, Jessica Wehrman, reporter for the Columbus Dispatch in Washington, and also Stephen Koff. He's Washington Bureau Chief for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. One topic I thought that they would be able to tackle, but that's just because maybe I don't know about the underpinning, you know, the partisan underpinnings, is postal reform. They have to do something to let the Postal Service make changes so that they can get a handle on their own losses. But nothing, I guess something happened in the Senate maybe, but nothing anywhere else.
I think the Senate approved its postal reform this spring, maybe it was May, and then the House hasn't brought it up. So, you know, this is another sort of case where there's a high level of uncertainty and nothing has happened. I feel
you,
like I'm saying the same thing.
And you have dueling sort of bigger picture views there of even what the Postal Service ought to do, what it ought to be, the role of private industry, the role of technology, and that sort of thing. And that also sort of plays a role here. And then you've got even differing views of who's to blame. I mean, is it waste, fraud, and abuse and mismanagement, or is it onerous pension rules that Congress forced on the post office and force them to account for some of their future pension liabilities in a way that others don't have to account for, which means they have to basically put aside a lot of their revenue, and they say otherwise they'd be doing just fine.
So, once again, there's some really deep-rooted problems that need to be dealt with before they can do anything like this or before they will, but what's the odds they're going to get to the deep-rooted problems? Because it sounds like those get to be pretty principled. Those are some pretty basic principles you're talking about then.
There's some
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, it's philosophical standoffs. I mean, you just sort of pick the issue, and there's a philosophical standoff that's holding it up. So,
I think cybersecurity and the reason why that ran aground this summer is because none of them really get it. They just don't understand it. You know,
system
that
of tubes.
Yeah. What about that? Anything or?
I can't address that very well. I would say indeed, I don't think they're very, they're very tech savvy, but their aides are. So, you know, they're the guys who are tethered to their BlackBerries.
Well, and you know, the thing is, basically, nothing's going to happen, I don't think, this week. Now, famous last words. Now, they'll run out and pass a bill, and I'll be wrong. But if anything would happen, it would happen probably during the lame duck session after the election. Because, you know, when they leave town this week, that's it. These are the jokes until after the election is decided.
If you, anyone out there has a comment or question for our guests, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Say, all right, so let's just say the president loses on November 6th. What in a lame duck session would you predict would happen then?
It is
a really good question. I mean, first of all, I think at the bare minimum, there would be something would be done on these taxes. Don't you think, Steve? I mean, I feel like that would be the big, making sure that these things are extended. That would be the bare minimum, and
yes,
possibly sequestration, doing something to undo it.
Short-term sequestration, because they're not going to come up with a long-term debt solution in a month and a half. I mean, they're just not. It's too big an issue. It's too difficult an issue, and we're talking about, you know, a target of 10 years worth of cuts. So a temporary sequestration fix, at least to sort of delay the bad stuff from happening right away. And likewise, they've got to deal with the tax extensions. Maybe there would be, if it looks like Republican leadership is going to come into the White House, perhaps it would be an extension of all tax cuts. Otherwise, I think perhaps you're going to get a solution where you have that cut off, that $250,000 cut off. Payroll tax one, I'm not so sure about. That one's a little bit tricky. I mean, if it looks like the economy is starting to do a little bit better, I'm not so sure whether the Republicans want to go along with extending that payroll tax again. I mean, there comes a point where you're at least philosophically, I mean, they're accounting gimmicks, but you're philosophically shortchanging Social Security in doing that. And if once you start extending a tax cut beyond 1 year, it becomes very difficult to eliminate that cut. In fact, you're then accused of raising taxes.
Right. And just because, like, say, hypothetically, if the president loses reelection, does it mean Congress will remain the same? It's kind of a strange year. I mean, things could go bad for the Republicans in Congress, even if the president loses.
There are a lot of different equations that could play out here. I mean, really. But, you know, I was actually thinking about, sort of regardless of who wins.
Yeah.
You keep hearing the phrase fiscal cliff. And, I mean, these are things that have to be resolved regardless of who the president is, you know, in January in some way. You know, I mean, at least some of this has to be, you know, knocked off the checklist, or else, I mean, it's really kind of a disaster scenario.
And if President Obama is reelected, would it be the same scenario, Stephen, or something a little bit different in the lame duck session?
Well, you may have the I don't expect the House to change. I think the House is going to stay under Republican leadership. So, you know, you easily could have a Speaker Boehner saying, well, you know, what's in it for me? Why should I? On the other hand, you know, realizing that the status quo can't hold and you're going to have to deal with it at some point, you may have a little bit more willingness to fold there. Not sure what's going to happen here in the Senate. Again, I'm not looking for anything long term, though, to happen in a lame duck.
Oh, period, really.
Oh, okay.
Next 2 years.
Well, okay, I guess that was my pipe dream question then. you know, one thing that everyone keeps talking about, jobs, as if they, you know, make them like the Keebler elves out there in Washington. But the bottom line is both parties accuse the other of blocking legislation designed to promote economic growth. No jobs coming out of Washington.
You know, if you do look at what Congress did this year, it was a lot of different quote unquote jobs bills that were designed basically to make the other party look bad. So,
but Ann, I mean, come back to how do you define a jobs bill? Are we talking about putting construction workers to work? Well, then are we talking about raising the gasoline tax? Uh-oh, you got a problem there. Are we talking about using federal money to make sure that the states don't keep laying people off? Then you're talking about funding local government and teacher jobs, and that's not very popular. Right now, you're talking about son of stimulus. You know, there's a way for it to be disliked by one side or the other.
And the Republican job bills, meanwhile, would be things that would deregulate or would aim to pare back on some regulations, because they say those regulations cause small businesses not to create jobs. So there's a lot of different ways to create a job, depending on your political philosophy.
Email from Brad in Columbus. It's a little lengthy but interesting. He says, my position is that I will cast my vote to remove anyone who took part in the delays and tactics aimed at removing this president. For example, anyone who took that pledge to Grover Norquist instead of listening and acting on behalf of the constituents they are supposed to represent will not get my vote. I see too much congressional attention. I'm fighting ideological battles and bringing us to the brink of default just to build a case and point back at election time to blame the other side. I am also wondering how all this attention to Ohio during each election actually translates into favorable treatment for Ohio once someone gets elected. Can your guests answer that? Other than pointing at the auto industry, there seems to be quite a bit of pandering for Ohio votes and then neglect. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I think that the first question is perhaps cloaked as a nonpartisan question, but you know, I think it clearly is geared toward the Republicans, because that's who took the Griffin Orquist pledge there. So, you know, I mean, basically he's saying I'm not going to support any or very many Republicans, and that's fine. That's his right. In terms of benefits for Ohio, let's use an analogy of the Republican National Convention. The Ohioans were seated, you know, way up front. They got attention. Media loved them. Where did they put the delegates? Out by the Tampa airport. People felt they were stranded. I actually had an editor back in Cleveland say to me, you know, wow, you guys must be like in the heart of it all. I said, no, I keep wanting to say, who did we tick off here?
Well, because the media goes where the delegates go.
Exactly. That's right. Yes, exactly. Right. So we were with the delegates, and the delegates were out by the airport. I mean, it was a fine place. I'm not complaining, but it wasn't like, you know, suddenly because Ohio is so loved and everybody covets Ohio's attention, then they take care of Ohio at every step. And likewise, I mean, you know, what is Ohio going to get anyway that another state's not going to get, unless you're talking about earmarks and pork? And in the old days, indeed, people could get favors and get a bridge built or get a highway built or get extra money for the airport. That's a lot more difficult now in this no earmark era or climate. So it's difficult for anybody from any state. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you are the bluest state or the reddest state and who's controlling the Congress, because it's difficult to get pork.
I guess someone's spending a lot more money on ads on television and that sort of thing. That's a benefit.
The TV stations are loving it. I mean, they're getting a lot of money. I was talking to somebody last week from one of these third-party outside groups that was putting $1 million into Ohio for 1 week's worth of buys. And I said, wow, that's a lot of money. He said, your state's expensive right now.
Yeah, well, seven major media markets, it's always a pinch.
Yeah.
What do you say to that, Jessica?
Oh, you know, I mean, Steve brought up earmarks. And, you know, actually, I think this is sort of a weird stance, but I kind of would think that, you know, one of the things that's contributed to the polarization in Congress has been the death of the earmark, because congressional leadership has no carrot or stick to offer its members. So it's not just the White House, but it's so you could, you know, you have members who are a little bit more willing to go rogue because it's not like they can take away their money. There is nothing they can lose, you know. There's a lot of arguments and really valid ones against earmarks. They're wasteful. They help lawmakers reward their donors. But, you know, back in the day, the earmark was a tool that congressional leadership could use to keep their members united. So, you know, without that tool, it's like a parent giving a kid a cookie to make him be good in church. You know, without that cookie, you're going to have a noisy little worshiper.
Of course, but now it's cell phones and iPads. So, Pat in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Pat.
Yes, I wanted to get back a little bit to military spending because, interestingly enough, I was just on my computer this morning because I heard Jesse Ventura last night on being interviewed. And although he's kind of a little wacko about a lot of things, I happen to agree with some of the things he says. And he was saying, you know, making the point that we have troops all over the world, which we do. And so I was just on my computer finding out that 41% of the military spending around the world is done by the United States. We're bearing 41%. I'm sure that is troops, munitions, et cetera, et cetera. And the next one in line is China, who spends 8%, Russia 4%, and then England, France, and Japan 3.5%. So we do spend a lot of our resources on the military. And I do think maybe it shouldn't be drastic, but I certainly think if we're going to cut entitlements and some of these other programs, we certainly should, you know. I also look at these two wars that we've had, and although nobody likes to say it because everybody wants to support our troops, mm-hmm. I think we have spent, you know, $4 trillion, according to Brown University, trillions of dollars on the wars. And to me, they've been absolutely useless. And in fact, I think part of our the people, the Arabs, yeah, and the fact that they're so inflamed right now has to do with these wars that we've gotten involved in.
Well, Pat, you know, it's a little off topic, but point taken, and we are running out of time. I just want to let Jessica and Stephen respond.
For
thanks for your call. I mean, there's the issue of cutting military spending. We're running out of time, but the sequestration would be across the board. You couldn't pick and choose what you cut from the military, and that's the problem.
Yeah, it's a shave off the top. And I do want to say, you know, to the caller's point, I hadn't heard the statistic. It doesn't really surprise me, you know, but we've been considered a superpower. And regardless of the war, we've been considered sort of the person who, you know, the cop in charge of the world. And that's sort of what we've done, what we've accepted, the role we've accepted as a superpower. But I would say that when you cut across the top, not only does it impact safety and security, there's also sort of other tangible benefits. For example, you know, we tend to lead in terms of research and development. Right, Pat is a prime example of that. A lot of the research and development that becomes something that you enjoy as a consumer is stuff that has its roots in military development. So, you know, there's a lot of cuts that you don't necessarily see at first until you, you know, kind of dig a little deeper.
Well, maybe we can all meet again after the election and see what's what.
I'm very quickly going to take another shot of that.
15 seconds.
You can't cut the military. Everybody hates it. Everybody hates you for doing so. You had the Air Force recommending some closures and consolidations recently. You would think that people would say, good, we're not going to waste money.
Nope.
We're going to spend money wisely. Instead, what do you have when the president comes to a Mansfield Air National Guard base? You've got everybody complaining.
Stephen Koff, Plane Dealer, Jessica Wehrman, Columbus Dispatch, thank you.
Thank you.
You.
It's All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.